For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you ready to take your screenwriting career to the next level? If you're a new or aspiring screenwriter who feels lost or stuck in your career, the Working Writer School is here to teach you what writing courses don't.
Former student Dylan Evans said, "There are a ton of writing classes out there, but this course helped me work through the stuff that I couldn't find anywhere else. I feel more prepared and more knowledgeable to take on the next phase of my writing career."
Writer Nicole Bennett said, "After taking this course, I have a clear framework for the mindset, productivity, networking, and financial management skills needed for longevity in this industry."
And Jay Burlingham calls this course the map. "This course has given me a map that I will return to again and again as I move forward in my career as a writer."
Use code MMIH for 10% off from now until January 31st and go to theworkingwriter.com. That's theworking, W-E-R-K-I-N-G, writer.com to sign up today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggles of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on Tubi, on iTunes, on DVD, on all the places digital.
I'm Liz. I'm writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently making others, including Best Friends Forever, which we'll be shooting this winter. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
This week, we welcome Tate Hanyuk on the show to talk about the transition from acting to writing and now to directing, and what it was like to make her first two feature films as a writer. Big shout out to the wonderful people at the Austin Film Festival for connecting us with Tate. Tate was on a panel that I was the moderator on, which Liz was originally going to be the moderator on, but then she didn't end up going to Austin, so I filled in. I got to meet Tate. We got along right away. We chatted right after the show. And then she was kind of like this amazing person during the film festival where she would just like introduce us to people and connect us to people and tell us about things and get us to parties. And so that's actually how we know Sean Colin Smith, is because she got us invited to Sean Colin Smith's party. So Tate is amazing. We love Tate. And this was a really great conversation. But don't go away, because after that, we play another round of The Game and we read a new iTunes review. But first, Liz, how are you doing? And before you even say that, you set dates for your movie? Tell us about this.
Oh, yeah. So we're February 19th to March 26th. We're 5-day weeks, taking it slow. It may be less time than that, but that's what we're blocking off right now. So dates are set for reels. And what I wanted to talk about is, you know, I've been like cutting things from my schedule to kind of free things up for paid work and kind of for Liz time. And I went on a hike today for like the first time in like months, and I came back and I wrote to potential investors for my movie that I had had as to-do list items for like 4 weeks, but was so afraid and sheepish. And we talked about it, last week or 2 weeks ago? And we're like, how do you approach investors and how do you make, you know, how do you raise money for a movie? And I'm there trying to answer, knowing full well that I'm like too scared to ask people for money for a movie. And then today I sent my emails out and one of those investors is going to read the script this weekend. So it's like,
wow.
I just think I was thinking about the importance of everyone's time and self-worth and hiking and how all those things can really contribute to, it doesn't have to be hiking, but all those things can contribute to you feeling like a little bit more power and like a more feeling of autonomy in your own life. So that's, I'm feeling really good today. And how are you?
That's awesome. So you wrote an investor this morning, a potential investor, and they already responded to you?
Well, these are two people that I've been like developing a really long-term relationship with. And one of these investors has been waiting for me to contact him for like a month.
Wow.
He already like was like, yeah, send it to me like a month ago. And I've just been like every day being like, I don't know if I'm ready. I don't know. It's like, Gary, I have to write the perfect email, you know, thinking about it too much.
Right, right. Right.
And I went on this hike today and I actually talked to my sister-in-law last night about this, and she's like, ask for everything, Liz. Ask for it all. And it was like this weird moment where someone was giving me permission to just be bold, just to be bold. And I had like the confidence to be bold today.
That's awesome. So did you set dates like knowing that you wanted to include that in your pitches to these people? Or was that just kind of like random, like not connected at all?
We have a weekly meeting with me and my producers, and we set dates, I think, 2 weeks ago. And then I think, I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes it's very hard to see the forest from the trees. So as I was writing a letter to this investor, I was like, holy shit, we have a lot of things in line. And I was like, oh, here's our deck. Here's the script. Here are our dates. Here are the loosely attached, heads of department. Here are all these things. And it's sometimes you get so buried in little tasks, you forget that you actually have a big picture that makes sense. So we had set those dates weeks ago, but I didn't know what to do with that information. And now I'm like, oh, that information could go to investors. That information could go to crew members. That information, it's not just like a task to make me feel better. It's like a task to prepare everyone for making this movie.
Yeah, totally. Well, and to get people to buy in, right? Yeah. Like the more that you have that you can give to potential investors, especially somebody who's already interested in the project, it just makes you look that much more of a good bet, you know?
Yeah. I think I talk a good game like 90% of the time, but I realize I don't apply a lot of those things to my own projects. Like,
right.
I'm like a teacher who can't do, you know what I mean? Like, I just like, whatever. And so that's what I'm trying to do is, Here, I know we have like limited time, but this is what happened. I noticed like that I hooked up two people, like one with like essentially a funded feature through an introduction and like another with like a head of a major studio. And I was thinking about it. And I was like, why am I not doing any of these things for myself? Why do I keep doing these like crazy favors for other people? So I'm trying not to do that anymore. I mean, I still want to help people, but I also would like to make this movie.
Yeah. Well, I'm asking is why haven't you done these things for me, Liz? No, just kidding.
I mean, no, sure. That's awesome. I mean, that's part of it too. It's like, why am I, it's like the person I hooked up was like an acquaintance. You know what I mean? Like that's right. Part of, it's like, that's weird. It's the decision making is weird.
I think sometimes the pieces fit, right? Like, you know, like sometimes somebody is the right fit for something or you can help them in a way that you wouldn't be able to help someone that you know better, you know? And I think that's a wonderful, magical thing to help other people, you know? Yes. But it's nice that you're going to apply that to yourself too, because yes, of course, if you do it for someone else, you should damn better do it for yourself.
I know.
You
know,
you don't want to like exclude yourself from your wonderful enthusiasm and charm and connections and whatnot, you know. So
sometimes you just need a real good hike to like shake the life back into you. But what's going on in your brain?
Oh, I don't know. It's been miserably busy on my project at my day job, and so I've been working really late every night, and I finally got my taxes submitted to my tax person because I have to like allocate all my taxes every year and stuff. And I normally try to do it before my birthday, which is like, you know, like, okay, I feel really good if I got it done before my birthday. And I started it like in February, and it just like, man, it took me forever. And then I was so busy on other things, I just didn't have time. I haven't been playing piano at all lately. It's been really like, I just been just working and, but I got the taxes done over the weekend, which is great. Okay. And then I started to play piano again, which has been nice. And I had a really wonderful weekend with my family, which was good. But yeah, no real anything with the movies. No news, just that we haven't heard back from the company that we're waiting to hear back from. They have not given us any sort of feedback. Yeah. So that doesn't seem promising.
Yeah, but it's also like this industry is insane. Like things take so much time.
I know, but I feel like if someone's interested, like it goes a lot faster generally.
Yes.
Like, but if like they're not interested, it just like it takes forever to get the no. And it's like, just tell me no now.
Rip like, off that Band-Aid. Yeah.
I'm sure there are plenty of examples of like where someone has taken like months to respond on something and then they've actually said yes. Like,
yes.
But that seems less like the norm than like, you know, you send something and then like, you know, a week later you're like, they're like, yeah, we're in, we love it, it's great, you know.
I love a fast no. I love me a fast no. Those are wonderful.
I've gotten a couple before, yeah. Which is great, you know, but yeah, it's usually a long no, which sucks. But yeah, I've still been thinking about my movie and writing and stuff, and I've kind of like come to this decision that like, you know, well, not decision, but just like acceptance that like I'm probably not going to get hired to make a movie, you know, as my second feature. I mean, maybe it'll happen, but like,
or maybe just not before the baby comes. How about why? Well, why would you
definitely set, not before yeah. the baby comes?
I don't know if you need to set limits of like ever. Maybe just not in the next few months.
I don't know why that's what my brain does, but like now I'm just like, okay, so like in 2024 I'll have a new script, you know, I'll be feeling really good about it, and I'll start raising money and I'll do the whole alternate process all over again. Like that's sort of like where my brain's at. But yeah, maybe something beautiful will happen between now and then where I'll get another opportunity, or another project will fall my way, or this one will happen, or one of the other ones that I've been have my foot dipped into will happen. We'll see. But I'm also like not like stressing either. Like I feel like, you know, I've got a baby coming and I'm really enjoying spending time with my family now. And so like when the family gets bigger, it's going to even be more fun. And so it's like, well, like there's no time limit. There's no like, if I don't make a movie for a couple of years, it's not like people are going to be like, oh yeah, Ulrich's not a filmmaker anymore. He didn't make a movie since like 2022 or whatever. 2020. Yeah. You know, oh yeah. 2022. That's when my movie came out. No one's going to be like holding me to the fire. Like what's wrong with this guy? So
no one I think cares. I'm just. No one cares. No one's gonna, thinking those things.
Let it happen when it happens and make sure that when I do make a movie that I really, really care about it, because I think that's really what's going to make it be good, you know?
Yeah.
It's me loving it. Because if I don't love it, it's only going to be as good as it can be, which is, you know, I don't know, not as good as it would be if I loved it.
Well, yeah, we've been having some hard sleepy nights lately. So, you know, when you're like insomnia, like different brain, you know, different things mm-hmm. come to your mind. And I've been thinking like, oh, the next project that I really put a lot of time into, I'm going to write. Right. Like, it's like you just see the pattern of being attached to projects and the waiting game and letting go and letting other people do what they're going to do. And ultimately, like, I actually think the next thing I'm going to do is like, I'm going to make like a Hallmark Mar Vista Christmas romantic comedy and just like have a silly fun time writing something like that, and then just see, can I sell a script, can I try, right? But it's like, yeah, bringing back less pressure for you and I in the coming months, I think is a really good strategy.
Yeah, which I mean doesn't really coincide with setting dates for your next feature in 2024, but
well, my dates are like 11 months from now. I'm going to be okay. I'll be all right.
Yeah. Still, I don't know. It's a lot of work. I mean, we all know how much work it is to make a movie. So, you know, but that does feel like a nice, comfortable time. I think if you didn't have a baby coming, I would be like, yeah, perfect dates. But you could have your second kid in the summer. Oof, that's going to be a lot to do. But you'll do it. I have all the faith.
Well, thank you. My brain is like, that's too far away from now, even with the baby coming. I'm like, too far away. My sister-in-law very kindly said, if you need someone to be your nanny on set, I'll be your nanny. And I was like, oh, I could bring her on set. So, there you go. And then I'm like, well, we could probably do it before February then. Anyway, we'll move on. I'm going to stop jumping the gun here.
Oh, my God. Well, what you should do with is not jumping the gun. You should go to our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast, and support us on Patreon. This is the way the show continues to live and breathe and exist. So if you're liking the episodes you're hearing, if you like the interviews, the guests, Liz and I's banter, that's the way to support it. Make sure it doesn't go away, because clearly, we all have lots of things happening in our lives that our time could be used for besides making a podcast. So, yeah, but every cent helps us stay focused on this. Also, don't forget to check out Jambox.io. They're a new royalty-free music and sound effects company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay, Martin Scorsese, or global brands like DJI. They even offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is really great. So use our code MMIH to get 20% off your yearly subscription today. But without any more delay, here is our chat with the most wonderful Tate Hanyuk.
So So Tate, can you give us the elevator pitch for Sex Appeal?
The elevator pitch, sure. So Avery Hanson-White is the best at everything, everything in the land. Until she realizes that she's kind of skipped all the high school milestones. And one of those includes losing her virginity. And so she's got to be the best at that. So, you know, because she's an engineer and Mensa and, you know, MIT bound, she's got to figure out an algorithm so that she can be the best at sex.
How many days did you shoot the film?
Oh my gosh, I should know that. But it was one long blur. I would say somewhere between 2022. I know we added an extra day at the end there. I can come back to you with it. I'm going to make a note. I'm going to come back to you with the final answer on that.
What can you speak of with regard to the budget?
I can say that with shooting out of state, you get a rebate. And I know that we were somewhere between, I think, 4.5 and 7. And because I'm the writer, I'll probably never really know the budget because that would change what I get paid. Because we get a percentage of the budget. So I think some things are likely kept from the writer for that very purpose of not owing them more money.
And then how did you come up with the idea for the script?
That's a great question. You know, it was one of those things where I think my whole life I've watched comedies and been the kid who wanted to be Ace Ventura talking with their butt, but knowing that like I was a lady and we don't do those things. So my whole life as an actor, like I wanted to be doing the boy parts and, you know, having that fun and watching a lot of these comedies from the male gaze. But like in my brain, I'm doing like the lady version. And it was just a very like natural thing for me when I would sit down to write was like just like center my sort of my perspective in those kinds of stories. So Sex Appeal, you know, kind of came from the sort of Superbad or the American Pie era of movies where essentially boys were like, you know, just trying to get girls drunk enough to get laid kind of movies. And at some point I was like rewatching 16 Candles and I was like, oh my God, that's so rapey. Like, did we really revere this movie? And then not too long after, Molly Ringwald started speaking up about that, or she wrote a wonderful article about it that somebody had sent me after I'd already written Sex Appeal. And it was just really like this, it's like this wonderful thing, like, you know, in when something becomes sort of in the conversation alongside the trends of filmmaking. So I had been telling these sort of female driven comedy stories like my whole writing career, which had not been a career yet. And then suddenly they were like of the moment. So it was just a really exciting moment when this female gaze on a teen sex comedy became like the thing that we needed. And I think ultimately that's what led to, you know, it being greenlit. Did that answer the question?
It does. But this question is going to help get more practical, more nitty gritty, which is When did that spark of inspiration happen? So like how long was the entire timeline of the film from coming up with the idea until its eventual release?
That's such a good question because, of course, these things can bake forever. And then sometimes something just like goes. So I would say it was like 2017 that I was writing that film and it came out of me so quick. It came out in like 13 days. I like from beginning to start, I was just like, it just was like one of those stories I was living with in my brain and it just cracked open and it was like, whoop. And of course there's the rewrite process and there's, you know, you do a reading for friends and then people give some thoughts or you realize that maybe the things that entertain you are not very entertaining to others and you tweak. But I had submitted that script into a couple competitions because, you know, sometimes you just want to see how things land with others. And I was in this place in my career where I had been writing a lot of different types of stories, but I wasn't sure what my particular voice was. And I think I was looking for that answer. So I submitted things in competitions to see, well, what's going to consistently do well across the board? So I do that in 2017, you know, a little bit of that in 2018. And in 2018, I won the Austin Film Festival with that particular script. And that is just such a like crack it open opportunity place for scripts. Not even if you win, like even just like even being a semifinalist, you get on their list that gets sent out to people who are looking for concepts and log lines. So I had some like incoming interest, which was really wonderful. And, you know, then there's the versions of the script that you write because you're sending a talent. So you beef it up a little and you might give that character a little bit more arc. And then there's the production pass that you do where if you want, you know, a really nice size budget, you like make it all, you know, it's like, oh, we've got rockets, we've got jets, you know, all the expensive things to really amp that budget up. And then there's like the actual green light purchase price that you get. And then you bring everything down and you start making everything inside. And, oh, we only need 62 students in this classroom instead of 60, you know, so it's, there's like many different phases of rewriting. But with this particular project, I would say it kind of got escalated because of COVID. So I think like there were projects that were held back because of COVID, but mine was one where it was like, we've got to get this into production during COVID. It was shot during COVID. Mm. So started writing it in 2017, 2018, it started circulating. Lots of rewrites. We got greenlit in 2020 and it went into production in 2021. There was a little bit of a like, you know, green light rewrite type process for Hulu because, you know, when you're on a platform like that, like there's specific mandates, like they're trying to reach like a slightly wider audience. So I had it from a very, very female gaze and like opened it up a little bit more, you know, for the male gaze a little bit more to make it, you know, across the board there. And yeah, so that was kind of like the timeline on it.
And what would you change if you could change one thing about the project?
If I could change one thing about the project, I think it would have been nice to not do it during COVID, but I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for. The tough thing with the comedy is like, you really want everybody to be able to have like time to, you know, integrate, create those relationships. For me, it's very important, like with teen comedies, especially if, you know, we want to buy that these kids have been growing up together, that you get that sense of camaraderie. Like, you know, they've known each other since elementary school. I do think we were able to accomplish that in our movie, but I do wish that we could have had an experience. It's like, you know, because you're flying people out and holding them up in a remote space, quarantining them, and then they're hitting set. And, you know, actors are so wonderful because a lot of times they're just like such open hearts and they'll just crack that open immediately. But it's like, I think in an ideal world, we would have had all kinds of rehearsal and like improv and, you know, and we did find those moments for it, obviously, but it's a very different kind of production. And it was the first thing that I had done in the COVID environment. And, you know, it's like you've got the people walking around being like 6 feet apart, you know, it's like you're at a school dance, you know, and everybody has to wear masks if they're not on screen and you kind of forget. So, yeah, there were different things that were like kind of the antithesis of building a comedy environment. But I think we survived it very nicely.
You said something so intriguing about mandates and having to incorporate the male gaze. And I can't not talk about what did you have to do to expand to incorporate the male gaze?
That's such a good question. I will say this. At first, like, I was a little like, I don't want to do it. This isn't the kind of stuff I write. But then backing up a step or two, it's like, well, ultimately, we want to invite everybody into these stories so that we think about them and we think about other perspectives. So I think it was like my instincts, like my hairs went up at first. And I think this has happened a couple times with different projects. And then I start to realize like, but wait a minute, if you're looking to tell a story to get, you know, information out or a perspective out or just kind of bring us all together, then it is important to bring everybody in. And I'd have to think really hard on what it was that was changed. I think there was a lot of like feminist rants. Mm-hmm. And I think like I enjoyed that as a writer, but sitting back on it, it's like, no, it's in there. It's baked into the concept as a whole. We don't have to hit on the head so hard, you know? And so I think I removed some of those and everybody was really wonderful about it. And quite frankly, I think they all understood where I was coming from and very supportive and they, you know, just wanted it to be successful. So it's like the more eyes we get on it, the better the project is. Luckily, like I was not forced to cut anything, you know, because of that, or I was not like, you know, pushed to do anything in a particular way. Like Hulu was really wonderful about, you know, their process and like really letting us do what we needed to do. Honestly, the bigger cuts, the bigger heartbreaks just came from time and schedule or, you know, just not making the day. Like those were the real cuts that happened.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So you kind of went super speed through the process. Like a lot of amazing things happened, like winning Austin, Hulu reaching out, like, you know, greenlighting the movie. Can you talk about like what the steps were? Like once you won Austin, like was it just like, hey, well, here's an offer and you're ready to go? Or were there lots of other things you had to do to get to that green light from that point?
Yeah, that's a good question. Cause it's like, you know, I remember sitting at home being like, actually, I still listen to your podcast and I'm like, well, how did they do that? How did you get it from A to B? So I'm really glad we're breaking that down. So from Austin, there was like a buzz that occurred. You know, once you've like won something, it's like easier to email people and be like, hey, I won this thing. You should pay a little closer attention to it. There was some incoming interest from companies who I think keep their eye on Austin and scripts that are coming out of Austin and other festivals like that. I had entered other competitions. This was the one that seemed to, while I'd been finalist at other competitions, this was the one that seemed to garner like the most like incoming interest. You know, it was one of those scripts where, and you hear this kind of thing and it's like so irritating to hear, but then like when it's actually happening, it like makes such sense. People always said, write the kind of script that circulates, that people pass to each other. And the truth of the matter is the most opportunities came from assistants passing it to other assistants. I was meeting at companies that like, I met at a company that like that made movies that I watched when I was a kid because an assistant passed it to another assistant. And a lot of the just like incoming opportunities were sort of those word of mouth things. I ended up on a list because somebody read it and then I ended up getting a job on another project from an assistant to an assistant to a list to an assistant. And it was just like this wonderful underground thing that was happening because I think people were connecting to this material and they hadn't seen this story quite yet. I think we're now in a space where we're seeing a lot of these stories, which is really wonderful. And then to back up, because I meant to mention this earlier, I think the Me Too movement was just like, I had already been in this space with this story and the Me Too movement kind of pushed it to the forefront of content that they were looking for, which was just like a wonderful moment of like activism crossing with art. And I love that intersection. But to back up on your question about the steps, so Austin, assistance, I was really lucky to know Joey Tuccio at Roadmap, who is just like one of these wonderful Roadmap writers. And he's got this organization where they, you know, pair writers with, you know, different executives and, you know, you're going on to like learn from them, but also pitch to them. And he knew of American High, which was this company that was making high school movies. They bought this high school out in Syracuse, New York. And it was just like the most brilliant thing. It's like, if you can make high school movies, like why not buy a high school? And I just loved that kind of forward thinking. And so we met very early, like before my script had even won Austin. And Joey had sent my script to American High and was like, you guys should talk. They read it. They loved it. It went in their database. But the option was like, it was low. And you know, they were starting up and they were getting their financing for things. So I was like, I'm going to wait a beat. I'm not going to quite attach to that. Like, I think that this, like, because I also was like willing to make it independently. I had written it in a way where it's like, I can scale this down to make it on my own. Or, you know, maybe there's more money. But you, as a newer writer, you're like, it's like the dream that somebody else would put money into your thing. But you also have to think practically, like, I might just have to make this myself. So I was kind of like open to whatever would come around. And it's that leveraging thing that happens where suddenly a company's interested. So then, you know, you're kind of like, well, hey, how interested are you? And so I was in this wonderful place of having a very, very big company who was interested, who was known for big, big movies. And I think it would have been like a theatrical release. And I had a company that was willing to make it independently. And we would try either the Sundance route or the festival circuit and also see if we could get theatrical. And then I had American High, which was going to be like they had a deal with Hulu, a distribution deal. And part of the reason I knew this was that I used to coach actors as like my side thing. I love acting so much, but I only play the characters that I look like. And it was so fun for me as an artist to work with younger talent and get to help them prepare for their auditions. I ended up with so many young people who ended up on TV shows. So I like kind of had this like side coaching thing I would do. People would always, like managers and agents would always send me their talent because they're like, oh, you're so good at like, you know, getting our talent on things. And I loved it because it's like, well, I'm too old to play this character, but I can give them all the choices and help them make all the choices so that they can get this role and they can go off and have a career. And so because I had this sort of insight to what their auditions were, I was seeing things come through the pipeline before American High had a deal with Hulu. So at first they were just American High. then suddenly I'm seeing projects come through that it's like American High and Hulu. And I'm so telling my manager, hey, you know, I think they must have like, I don't know, like an overall situation. I don't know what those are called, but it seems like they're kind of doing movies together. Like, you know, I feel like we should check that out. And at the time it was like, no, you want a theatrical release because like that's where the money is. I mean, to me, I didn't understand any of this. I'm like, I just want to see my story made. I just want my character to have her goal. But, you know, when the pandemic hit, it was like, there are not like theatrical options. What movies were being made theatrically? So to me, it made perfect sense to jump on the American High Hulu thing and try to make that happen before we were doing movies. And luckily, it like at the same moment that I'm having this instinct of like the, you know, the world is shutting down. This is 2020, like April. I hear from American High, hey, listen, we sent your script to Hulu. Like, we're now doing business with them. We would, you know, would it be okay to like, you know, get in a conversation about this? And I'm like, yes, yes, my producers, my manager, everybody needs to talk so we can make this happen, because it just felt like the perfect avenue for it. Also, where do teenagers watch movies? On their phones, on streamers. You know, like I thought that was much more likely than going to a theater. So instead of like holding out for the big theatrical thing, which would have been nice and I would have loved that, I was more interested in getting the story out to the world, because we didn't know, you know, like when this would become dated material, or if that, you know, sort of moment would go away, or if COVID would shut things down. So we jumped into a deal, and I couldn't be happier that we went for it. Did that answer everything?
Yeah, covered it.
Okay, sorry. I know I tend to do a wandery. I need to beat out my answers. Like,
no. Before I don't you dare. Well, so that was like the 20-foot view, right, for the process. But what I think people aren't aware of, that I'm only now becoming aware of, is that you are a multi-hybrid creator. You know, you are, is that a right term? Who knows? You are a performer, you're a writer, you're a director, you're a producer. I mean, can you, is it okay? Can you bring people into the world of where the pockets of talent lie?
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. And yes, I think it's one of those things where you set off to do something. Like, I'm actually a theater kid. We could frame me as a theater kid. And everything that I do comes from this place of like making theater and doing plays with my friends. That is how I operate. And that is how I look at the world. And that's always what I'm looking to recreate, is like that crazy tech week where you're throwing up the show at the last minute and then you pull it off. I'm always looking for that moment. So I started doing children's theater. I was in a tour of Aesop's Fables. We would go to elementary schools at like 7 a.m. and we'd have to track down our degenerate castmates who had been partying the night before and figure out where they passed out, throw them in a van, throw on a bee costume or a mouse costume and go teach moralistic tales to children of the world. And then we'd be like, you know, all tuckered out by 2 p.m. and then have to be on stage for a main stage show later that night. And so I was just, because I was part of this theater company that did the children's theater tour, kind of kept the theater alive. But then you had these, you know, the bigger sort of adult shows at night. I don't mean adult in like a sexual way. I mean like the audience of adults. And so, you know, it was always Fast and Furious and we were always doing comedy, and just watching the people that I revered, like these older actors who were just so incredible, who were just like, could do anything. I got this wonderful like ground of comedy training. And we had one of our founders of the theater was Tim Busfield, who happened to be, you know, on
Wait, well, sorry, I got excited because I thought I knew who that is. That Field of Dreams? No. Yes? No.
Yes.
Okay.
So Tim, you know, he and his brother Buck had formed this company, and like there were other founders like Aaron Sorkin, like, you know, there were people who were like big names who were doing, you know, this was like their little side thing that they were doing. So I was very lucky to have a teeny bit of access. Like, you know, at least I knew one person who was associated with Hollywood. So in between these equity shows that I was doing, I would come down to LA and like give, you know, kind of give it a little shot. I would do my commercials. I would like make it in a couple movies, make it in a couple TV shows. And over time, I was able to sustain that a little more. And I stopped doing the equity theater and I started like booking more and more TV and film. But I always wanted to direct. I always wanted to write. But because I was standing in the position of an actor, it just felt like such an impossible like thing to tackle. Like, you're just always in the actor seat. And so I didn't understand what like the pipeline for that stuff was. And I would say to people, like, I really want to direct, but like, I wasn't going to go to film school. Like, I didn't know other directors per se, or how they were doing it just was so different. Or when I was on a set, my role was to be an actor. You just didn't cross those lines, but I was always really, really, really curious about it. And so then, you know, as I mentioned, I, at one point, like, cause I was never quite satisfied with the types of roles I was playing. It was fun at first. And then you're kind of like, oh, I'm doing the sort of logical wife thing again. And there's so much more underneath, and I want to just do such more interesting stuff. But those roles weren't exactly available to me because I wasn't as much of a character actor or I wasn't a guy. And so I just started writing. And again, like you're sort of showing your scripts to people where producers are like, oh, that's so cute. You're the actor with the script. And it was just really hard to get people to look at me in any different way. I started making web series. I found a friend who was, this is like the best advice I can give. Find somebody who does the exact opposite things that you do and make stuff together. Because a lot of times, like your friends are like, a bunch of actors can only like put up a play, right? But if you make friends with a director DP, then they're like, well, I need things to, you know, direct. I need things to shoot. And I was like, oh, I can write and act in them. So we had this wonderful collaboration where like he would shoot and edit and direct things. And I would write them and come up with like all the creation and all this stuff. And we were doing this for years. We were terrible business people because we would just have so much fun making it that these things never went anywhere. But once in a while, I would show them to somebody and be like, this is a really great idea for a show. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, on to the next idea. Slowly but surely, I started to learn like that's a creator. Like that's what a creator does. That is literally what creators do. I'm now represented by CAA as a creator. It never occurred to me the stuff that I'd been doing for 10 years was actually like legitimate creating. You know, it's just like an access point. I didn't have agents who were working in that space who would go, oh, we could sell this idea. Now I do. But for all these years, I was just making my little plays and shooting them and sending them to my friends and, you know, I was like, tap out at 600 views and that was that. I think so much of it is like, who do you know? Do you have somebody that you're watching that's doing a different thing? I think what's so nice about your podcast or like, you know, the fact that we have social media is you can follow another filmmaker and see how they're doing things. At the time when I was, you know, coming up, like that wasn't really, you had to like actually physically know a person. So like I was able to get into Hollywood because I knew someone who was doing it. Tim Busfield. I ended up on one of the Aaron Sorkin shows playing a comedy development executive. I now meet comedy development executives. I had no idea when I was playing that role on TV that their job actually existed. Like it didn't occur to me in my like actor space. Like this is a real job. People really do this. Now I meet with those people all the time. So, you know, it's like this compilation of like all these things that you do that you love to do in your career. And it kind of informs the way in which you approach the ultimate thing that you're looking to do. I knew I always wanted to direct. I knew I always wanted to write, but I was just always being cast. And so I didn't know how to get out of that. And now it's just this wonderful position of getting to write things for my friends. And like, or when I write, it's like all of those roles that I'm creating, like I get to play them in my mind and put them on the page. And then someone else gets to bring it to life. And I'm very inspired by the people that I know, like, you know, the quirks that they have. I love to write for friends. I am inspired by that all the time. It's my favorite thing in the world when I get to cast somebody in something and then they bring it to life and everybody loves them and thinks that they're great. And now I'm getting to step into the director's seat, which is ultimately where I always wanted to be. And each of those other things was just a training ground to be better at that. Now as a writer, I understand storytelling, so I can do that as a director and like, you know, a heartbeat. As an actor, I understand what my actors are going through, so I'm able to kind of like navigate that stuff for them and kind of have empathy for how they must be feeling or what, you know, the extra things that they might need. You know, I'm finding my way through post-production. They always say that is the hardest. I know you guys know, but it's a whole new world, that post world.
Can you talk a little bit about getting your first directing opportunity? Like, how did that come about? Like, what is this thing that you're directing? And, you know, what did you do to prepare yourself to direct your first project?
Oh, great question. So funny enough, there was a script read. So this project is called What's the Elf? And we're actually premiering tonight. And it is based on the creator, the actress creator. She was working in a Santa picture house as an elf, like helping take the pictures. And in like, you know, Hollywood at the Grove. So it's like, that's a whole scene, right? That's a very interesting world. So the premise of the show is a failed actress who used to be on a really like terrible network show ends up working at the Santa picture house. She thinks it's a gig. Turns out it's like the way that the job posting was listed, it felt like an actor audition, but it was more than so she ends up having to work at this place. And so I had actually done a table read of that project years ago before COVID. They raised a bunch of money. There was going to be, this is when like short form comedy was like really having its moment. And so there was a lot of talk of it becoming a short form series, you know, as either a concept piece or just, you know, because people were funding that kind of, you know, Quibi was still alive. So everybody was coming up with things for Quibi. So that, unfortunately, because of COVID, it was too expensive for them to shoot. And so they ended up just shooting this last summer. But what was so nice is that, you know, I had actually read for one of the main characters in The Table Read when they first presented it to the world. But in that time, I had two movies come out. My writing career had taken off. I was, you know, starting to write for different companies. And so there was just like a different gaze on me. And I had always been known amongst my friends as somebody in the comedy space. And I worked a lot with young actors in the comedy space. So I had a little bit of that branding to me. And at some point, they were like, well, maybe Tate would want to direct this. And I was like, yes. Because early on, 2 years prior, they had said to me, do you know any female comedy directors we should approach? And a piece of me was like, me. But I knew I didn't have, like, you know, the clout behind me to step into that yet. But then sure enough, time had passed and I had started making my own projects on a higher level. And I think that gave me like a little more cachet. And suddenly I was the one that they approached. And as far as what I did to prepare for it, honestly, it was like, you know, every project you go through, and I'm sure you guys feel this too, it's like you learn what not to do and you learn what you do want to do. And like, if something's like a really tough production, like, my goodness, do you learn more? It's like the problems actually become the gift of education. And so, you know, putting up Sex Appeal through COVID, we also shot, my producing partner, Steve Acevedo, who is the director of Love and Baseball, that's a movie that we shot for $20,000 and it ended up on HBO Max. Like, it's the biggest win in the world. It was like this thing that we made that we didn't expect to have much of a run or a win. And it has had like this massive like impact on his career, on the playwright's career. And so, you know, kind of just like that training ground of doing things on a bigger level. And, you know, having people like working under people that were on another level was really like just so informative for me. You know, it's always important to shadow as a director and, you know, have your own experiences. I had stood as an actor, like in that position. I'd done 100 commercials. I'd done, you know, like, I don't even know how many TV shows and movies. And so you're watching all the time. You're absorbing that stuff. But like, until you're doing it, it doesn't like quite feel like, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, wait, no, that's what it is. That's what set is. I've been doing this all along. So that was just like a really nice, like it all kind of amounted to the moment.
In terms of just comedy and comedy training, how does one train and how does one refine? Like there seems to be a thread of comedy, right, that you're talking about in your strength in comedy. Is it natural or are you going and doing sketch or stand up or improv to keep certain muscles active? Or just tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think everyone in the industry should do improv, mostly because like the golden rule of improv is yes. And like when you're on a project and you've got somebody saying no, like it just shuts the creativity down. Like in any particular department, it should always be okay. And it's like, maybe they don't agree, but it's like, well, what's the in-between between the thing that's being asked of them and like their idea? There's an in-between. And like, that's how things grow. So to back it up, I know that it is very common for actors to participate in improv. UCB is a great place. There's a couple other like upcoming sort of sketch places that I think are a little bit more indie. I've heard a lot of people going to. It's not coming off the top of my head at the moment. But, you know, being a part of those communities is really great just to like work together. People are always creating stuff. So that's, I think, a really helpful thing to keep stretching yourself. Like there's also the formal acting classes and stuff, but I don't know. It's like, we're kind of past the era of like, you know, I think back in the day, there was like waves of, because I came from theater. It's like, you know, there was like this theory of acting and this theory of acting. You would see over time how it would like change performances in movies. Like what was like the hit thing? Is everybody doing Meisner now? And so it kind of feels like today, like the brand of acting is like authenticity. Casting is so much about, can we find that person who is that person? And so I feel like at the end of the day, we're all just looking for everybody to be their most authentic on the page and their most authentic on screen. And being authentic on screen comes down to being comfortable with yourself. So improv is just such a great place to kind of like get it all out and go with it and just be like, here I am. You know? And then as far as people who do stand up, like that seems like the hardest thing in the world. I've never done that. I've always thought of it. Like I have my dream set that I do in my head, but it's really only funny to me. But it's like, you know, the people who do stand up are some of the most coveted in the comedy space because they have their own voice in particular. You know, when they're going to say a line, how that line is going to be delivered. And that is like one of the things that really helps comedy be so successful is having like very specific different voices to land jokes.
So now that you're like writing, directing and doing all these other things on top of the acting, like, are you still pursuing an acting career? And then how are you juggling both of those? If you are, like, are you still doing auditions or are you kind of phasing that part of your career out to focus more on the creator side of things?
Yeah, I'm mostly focused on the creator side of thing. It brings me more joy to be able to give other people jobs. Like, I just really enjoy being able to like create something and then like be able to be thinking of like this list of friends who I really feel deserve a shot. And like, they're going to be hopefully up for this opportunity. That drives me more than hustling for the acting opportunity that I know I'm up against. Like, oh God, who knows how many other people. I will say that since COVID, like a really great thing that's occurred is pretty much people can audition from everywhere. If you are like somewhere in the Midwest and you have a ring light and a camera and a backdrop, you absolutely can be auditioning for pretty much anything in Hollywood. And so that open access is just like, it's awesome. It also means there's so many more auditions coming through for casting directors to watch. Like a couple years ago, it's like they might only be able to hold so many appointments during the day. So if you're one of those people who's getting in for that in-person appointment, you've got a pretty good shot of making it to producers. They're going to narrow it down from there. And then once I'm in a room for producers, I tend to like really turn it on because I love to perform for like people. And you know, if you've got a little bit of an audience, it always helps. And that made it easier to book a job. Nowadays, it's like you tape an audition and you send it into a void. You kind of never hear anything. And you have to do it for the love of it. You have to do it for the love of just standing in front of your little backdrop and just like having your little fun with yourself, because you will likely never hear a thing or interact with a person. Maybe your agent is like, good job. But I think a lot of people don't even quite get that. For me, it is very time consuming to learn lines and shoot an audition and make sure everything's just right. And I also live near an airport, so there's a lot of planes. I'm sure we'll have a couple of those. So they're always ruining a take. So admittedly for me, at this moment in time, I'm more focused on the creating opportunities because I feel like that can feed so many creative souls, whereas the acting opportunities feeds just my soul. But anytime someone's like, hey, I'm thinking of you for this, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. I am definitely going to put myself as like a small quirky teacher part in just about anything I can. Like, I will always try to play something in anything that I do because I have so much fun with it. Like, you just kind of like want to be a part of it, you know? But at the moment, it's not the focus. I would love it if I could just like land on a consistent acting thing, because it's so easy to be an actor, not the getting the job, but once you're on the job, like they tell you where to go. They tell you when to stand up and go to that place. They tell you when it's time to eat. They have a table with all the food set up. And then they're almost like, you can eat this or this. Like, you're literally told to do everything in the nicest of ways. You're just shuffled around like a little baby bird. You don't have to do any thinking. You just have to do your lines. When you're a creator, your brain is just like, oh my God, I'm so fatigued from decisions, like coming up with ideas and solving problems. And you guys know, because you've done your own stuff, like the post process or the shooting process, like the number of questions coming at you from every angle. There's so many questions and answers to be answered. As an actor, you just kind of stand there on your mark and say your lines. It's great. Oh, and someone does your makeup? So easy.
I feel like, I'll speak for myself. I'm only getting like maybe 35% of the teams that you are involving in these projects. Like, you mentioned your producing partner. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I understand like the coming up in the equity world and the collaboration that you participated in then. But right now, who's your regular team? Like, who are the people you communicate with the most?
That's such a great question, because it is so important to have a team. Like, you cannot do this stuff in a bubble. At first, I had this wonderful writing lab. It was just like a group of actors and we would get together and share our stuff with each other. And it was like, you would not only bring your stuff to class or lab and, you know, do it and read it and be excited about what you were doing, but you'd also be super excited about what they were doing and kind of like invest in like their project. And so maybe that person would go off and make a short film or their own web series, or they're like submitting something to a competition and everybody's just like equally invested in that thing, like taking off. So pre-COVID, I had a writer's lab that we would do that and meet. And it was the best. I would say that was my team. And I would pull those people into my short films that I was making. They would be in them, you know. And honestly, I lean on Steve a lot because he can kind of do anything. He's a jack of all trades.
Steve is the producing partner, right?
He's the producing partner. Okay. So Steve has, like, I would say for like 10 years or so, he and I have been like a two-headed monster of he shoots, edits, and directs. And then I'm like production design, casting, you know, wardrobe, like all the other bells and whistles, craft services. Like, I'm just like that hustler who's like getting everybody involved. And we've done everything together, from like commercials to short films to web series to an independent feature, music videos. Like, we just love doing that stuff. But both of us were pursuing our own track. He was trying to direct TV and I was trying to be on TV. Lo and behold, we're like together as a team, we're able to like fill out a lot of roles. I think most people have like a couple more people wearing other hats. It's primarily him and I, as far as like our own little hub. But at this phase now, I have representatives who like, it's a newer thing for me, but I've got a manager. And so I will send him my work and he'll be like, not a studio movie yet. And so then I send it again and it's not a studio movie yet. And I send it again and I'm like,
without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I hope one of these days I really nail this high concept thing we're trying to do. So now I have like somebody who is like been in the business in a deep, deep way, is like represents some big clients as sort of a gaze on my work to kind of help me think on a higher level, which is great. And so that is like, he is now a piece of my team.
So let's talk about that. Like, how did you get your reps? Like, was it like a result of, you know, Sex Appeal getting greenlit and everything and winning Austin? Did it happen before that? After that, like, talk us through the process.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so many avenues to it. So Roadmap Writers was very helpful for me in that space because, again, like I had acting reps, I had scripts, but it was just like I was branded as an actor. It was really difficult to get out of that. So I, you know, went to Roadmap to do, you know, the classes to kind of like figure out how to get an agent and whatnot. So that was like an avenue I was pursuing because they were directly connecting people with representatives. I was also entering in competitions knowing that sometimes the people who are reading those scripts are like people who are like hired out. So sometimes an assistant at an agency might be getting paid on the side to read scripts for these competitions. And if they spot something that they like, you may get an email from them. So it's like that can be like, that's, you know, you're obviously submitting for the competition, but you have to think about the readers of the competition. Sometimes these readers are people who, like, I wrote a couple of Lifetime movies. The reason that happened is because a reader from a thriller competition I'd entered was like also looking for female-driven thriller scripts. And that reader like reached out to me and was like, hey, do you have other ideas? So it's like that became an avenue. But back to the manager of it all. So it's like trying one thing never works. I'm sure you guys know because you've had to hustle for your own projects. It's like you have to have like a couple different avenues and like one of those might kind of hit sooner than the other. So there's, you know, the sending your scripts to friends or knowing somebody who's represented or, you know, somebody who's like not in direct competition with you, you know, sending, like if I had an actor friend at a company that had lit management, I would be like, hey, do you feel comfortable sending my script to your manager to pass on to the lit department? You know, those kinds of asks, there has to be something in it for the other person. So it's like a lot of times it would be like, and there's a great role for you in this. So, you know, it's like there needs to be some kind of incentive. Otherwise, you're just asking people, you know, 2 hours of their time to read your script. So that was one thing that I would try, the sort of pay to play situations where you're kind of paying to meet people, the mixers. Austin, while it did help, funny enough, like, you know, managers have their own clients and they have their own taste. And so it's like, great, you want a thing. I'm reading this thing. It's great. It's not what I inherently love and do as a human. These are not the themes that I connect to. So great script, but like, that's not going to like garner representation. What I've learned about the management game is it has to be so personal. Like the connection has to be so personal. The kinds of stories that you tell, the kinds of stories that they are looking to tell. Another thing that I did was I watched Q&As from literally every manager agent I could find online to see whose like themes were in line with the themes that I was interested in writing. Who's like, who's super into the underdog story or who doesn't like mind the YA space. And then I would query some of those people because it was like, this seems like a specific target. Hitting anybody from management or like representation, it's like they get inundated with this stuff. So it's like, there has to be like some personal connect. I wouldn't do a lot of these, but just a few. Also, I would look at the tracking board list. And there's probably like tons of other lists that come out. This is just one I'm mentioning and seeing like what writers were kind of like noted as like kind of stepping into the business that year and which of the managers had like the most number of writers on that list. And so I had kind of like done like a little like, oh, well, this person had about 5 people hit this year and this person had about four people make this list this year. They must be really open to new writers. So then, after doing my research, do those writers kind of write the kinds of things that I do? Then I would query them. It was ultimately the reason I got management was a friend of a friend knew somebody. I also had roadmaps submit me through them. And also I had found them on this particular list and done my research, you know, to make sure that it was like a home run of a fit if I was going to make that ask. And so the Austin helped, hands down, it helped. But finding the right fit came from a lot of research and, like, you know, really sussing that out.
Oh. Mark, do you have a follow-up? Is that what you're...
No, I was just saying it was a very detailed answer. It's very good. So yeah, no follow-up.
It's a lot of work. It's like getting reps is almost as hard as writing a whole script. Like, you can spend the entire year trying to do just that. I will say one, like, little thing. The gift that came from Sex Appeal when the script went out to talent, and, you know, they were looking for like the sort of larger attachments to, you know, to play the parents. I got an incoming. This was like just like the most wonderful thing in the world because I had been trying to get an agent for years. I mean, it's like, how many scripts do you need to get an agent? How many like competitions do you have to be finalist on and or win to get an agent to notice you? Couldn't for the life of me. My script, Sex Appeal, goes to ICM. Ayala Cohen reads it for one of her clients. She connects to my voice. My email is on IMDb. She emails me directly. I see you're not represented. You know, can we chat about that? This is a partner at ICM. It was like, oh my God, the most amazing thing in the world. And she's just the best person on earth. And from there, like, she helped me build a team. And so it's like, it was just one of those beautiful wins that, like, sometimes you just crack so hard on something from the bottom of your soul. And then, like, there's like an easy thing that comes along that just like you couldn't have anticipated. And that was a real win that came with it.
Mm. I think it's time for our final questions. Final five.
Oh, are we in final five already?
We're there. So what's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
The best filmmaking advice I've ever received. Something along the lines of, this won't be a great quote, but something along the lines of, like, kill your darlings. There is always this idea in your head of what it's going to be. Then as a writer specifically, then you go to execute it as a director. And it's still like, this is it. As the writer, I was so wrong. This what I'm doing now, this is it. Then you get into the edit. And it's like, okay, well, that's not working either. So you have the edit version. You're like, no, this is it. And then you get into like the post like this. And like, it's just constantly going to evolve. It is going to be like an ugly baby and you're just going to shape all the way through. You have to let go of like the initial impetus of something will kind of run its course at some phase. And then it is time for a new idea to take its place. And you have to be able to do it. Otherwise, you're like holding your moment or your project back. You know, it's going to be full of those.
And what's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
The worst filmmaking advice. Oh man, I wish I had a good one. I feel like there's probably plenty. I think there's a lot of, you know, advice around make sure everybody knows you're the boss. I think that's something, especially for women, that it's like, you know, you have to be a certain way so that everybody knows who's in charge. I honestly believe, like, if you work from your heart, like, other people recognize that and they step up with their heart and then you have the best experience possible. I think the business is changing a lot. I've in the years that I've been in it, like, the screamers are going by the wayside. You know, a lot of that is like you just see less and less of it. And I really hope we're stepping into a moment where leadership can lead with kindness and that's not a weak thing. So I definitely lead with kindness and I'm kind of silly and I'm just myself and I am like wholly myself and I care about people and I care about what I'm doing. And I have often been told like I need to put on a particular facade. And I'm just like, I might be an actor, but I'm not good at that when it comes to this kind of stuff. I just have to be me. And I think that I'm finding there are just more and more people that respond to that. And those are the people I'm going to work with.
For what it's worth, a lot of women give an answer that's similar to that. And then I've also had that experience where people tell me to be a boss bitch. I just think it's a constant thread in unsolicited advice to women that needs to go by the wayside and needs to be put in the trash.
Hands down to what you're saying. And we just need to see different kind of leaders so that there can, you know, be a new phase of leadership.
Yeah. What's your goal as a storyteller?
My goal as a storyteller is to employ all the talented people I know and love and to just keep that going. I have seen a lot of dirty Hollywood and I know that business has to be business, but I think we can do business, you know, and still be good to each other. And there's so much like support for activism and content. And also kindness in content. It's as simple as that. So I just want to create stories that bring smiles, that bring laughs, and, you know, bring untold stories and unrepresented demographics to the forefront. And I just want to participate in as much of that as possible.
If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice that you would give yourself?
I think it would be to just get it out there. Like, find somebody who's doing what you're doing and watch what they're doing. It took me just a little too long to figure that out. And mentorship is so important. I'm still having a hard time finding a mentor, but like finding a mentor and watching somebody who's doing what you're doing and figuring out how they got there, keeping your gaze on that, and also not worrying about what other people are doing. Because, and this is actually advice, I'll bring it back to Tim Busfield. He gave me this as an actor once. He was like, there's literally nothing you can do as an actor to not get a job that is meant to be yours. And you go in there and you're just like, you've rehearsed it 100 times and it's like the big test for the network, and you're gonna do everything perfect. And then like, it might just not be yours because it was always meant to be somebody else's. I have been under the most pressure of my life, like as a performer, running like 101 fever. Like there's no world in which I should have like comedic timing or the physical ability to pull off the gag, and something would channel. And then on top of it, I'd improv the perfect line. You're like, where does that come from? Like sometimes there is just like magical thing that happens when you tap into it and you're just open to that channel. And it really is true. Like if something is meant to be yours, there's just like nothing that you can do to stop it. And trusting that the roadblocks that we hit, and my God, I've hit them. Those were the lessons. Those were the lessons to make sure that when, you know, you do get that opportunity, you were ready for it. And I can look back, and it's like always easier to look back. But everything I've encountered that has been a really difficult roadblock in trying to be where I am standing right now, all the things I needed to learn to confidently stand where I am right now.
Just because we have a minute, I'm just going to go back to the beginning of that answer. You kind of implied that it had taken a long time to get where you are. But I would say from Ulrich and my vantage point, you've had a whirlwind of a high flying, very fast career. So I guess what's appropriate timing in your mind? What would have been more appropriate?
Well, I guess it's a little harder of a thing to track too, because I've worn different hats, right? Like you always hear that it's like, oh, well, a star isn't made overnight. Like that took Steve Carell 10 years or probably 20 years. It almost seems like everybody, it takes about 10 to 20 years, right? And I have worn different hats. So while I was writing a lot as an actor and not really, really taking that seriously because I didn't understand what the path would be, I've been doing that for a really long time. It has suddenly become a whirlwind of, and now you're in, and now there is work and you're hustling for that work. But, you know, it's been essentially from like my theater days to now, it's been a 20-year career, you know, but all of those things have informed each step along the way. And they've all been the film school. They've all been the education for the ultimate, you know, creatorship.
And the final question is making movies hard?
Oh my God. Making movies is so hard that it's like what I imagine birth to be, that it's just probably so awful. But then there's those hormones that kick in that make you happy, so you can't notice how bad it is. And then you forget about it because you do it again. I think it's that hard.
Wow. So where should people go if they want to learn more about you? Do you have a project out now that, like, should everyone go watch Sex Appeal on Hulu? What should people do?
That's such a good question. Thanks for the plugs. Sex Appeal is on Hulu. Love and Baseball is on HBO Max. I know we didn't talk a ton about that, but it was like, it's an inspiring story of like 20 grand and a group of friends who adapted a play and made a movie during COVID and is now on HBO Max. And it's just like the best win in the world. And then I am not sure where What's the Elf will be distributed yet, but we are premiering that tonight for our cast and crew.
Ooh.
Amazing. Thank you for being on our show.
Guys, thank you for doing everything that you do to help bring all of us together and help us not stumble and fall along the way so we can listen to other people's stumbles and falls.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show! Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Tate?
Look, I just remember the way that you and Eric fanboy over Tate is like the most... adorable, charming thing ever. Because like Tate is worthy of the fanboyness. and I will fangirl over her. I really liked her. But there's like that she has charmed you too into like complete adoration. And I think probably because you met her at Austin and like had that in-person time. So I remember it being a solid good conversation. But what I really remember is like, Tate, if you're listening, you come up all the time. Like you are brought up all the time in just you being a wonderful person, a great guest, well-connected, charming individual. So
yeah, Tate's great. If you haven't met Tate, you don't know what you're missing. She's a wonderful person. Yeah, I feel like if you had met her, you'd probably be, yeah, like you said, fangirling too, because she's got this amazing energy. She's always smiling. She's just this really encouraging, wonderful person. Like I was a little nervous before the moderation, but then we just had this conversation and she completely put me at ease. And, you know, she kind of gave me some heads up of like, you know, what to talk about and like, you know, a little bit of like, I kind of like gave her like what I was going to talk about a little bit. And we just had like a nice little conversation. It just really made the whole thing wonderful. And then afterwards we had a really great conversation too. And he learned more about her and as an artist and a filmmaker. And then like, yeah, just kept on running into her throughout Austin. Just like, oh, there's Tate. Hey. And she's like, oh, here's somebody you should meet. Oh, there's Tate. Hey, come over here. Oh, my friends. It's like, oh my God. So wonderful. So yeah, but I mean, back to the actual conversation. I think we got to talk a little bit more about her film, Love and Baseball, which like we didn't talk at all about on the panel because it just wasn't time. But that was a really cool project. And I'm like bleeding in all my conversations with Tate into like one. So I don't know what we said on the show and what we didn't. But just how that whole feature came together and like working with her friend and like doing it in her apartment. Mm. Yeah, it's a really cool story of just like, yeah, let's go make a movie. And you know, they sold it to like HBO Max or something. And like kind of amazing, like what they were able to pull off with that thing on like such a low budget and like such a scrappy small crew, basically taking a play and adapting into a feature, you know, and then doing it like with a like nice contained team is pretty cool. But what is also very cool is our wonderful recurring segment, The Game. So if this is the first time you've listened to the show, we do this thing called The Game. It's like a game that we play. That's why it's called The Game. And Eric Toms, our producer, he's the one who came up with it. And basically what it is it's like an indie filmmaking challenge. It's like an indie filmmaking quandary. It's like basically a scenario that is set up and then one of us has to answer blindly and, you know, come up with a solution of like what to do in the situation and how to solve this like issue on set that you're facing or like, you know, trying to get a movie made or various different things. So it's Liz's turn to answer the question. So I've got it right here and I've not read this really. Liz has not heard this. This is all fresh and new. Here we go. This is from Eric Toms. You're in pre-production on a no-budget feature. You've been the driving force behind bringing this project together by writing the script, casting the actors, directing, producing, and coming up with a plan for distribution after the project is complete. You've enlisted the help of your very talented friends and are excited to get to work. However, you lay out your plan and you find a few department heads have interpreted your script in a different way. Suddenly, wardrobes are being changed and sets are being styled differently. You try to steer everyone in the direction you had intended, but they have their own thoughts and you're worried it may jeopardize the integrity of the film. Do you let your friends have free rein? They're working as a favor to you, so let them be creative. It may surprise you. B, lay down the law and let them know that this film is your baby and you have a very specific vision. You appreciate their work, but your creativity fits together like a lattice. See if you can't find some common ground between the two visions. Maybe use half of your ideas and half of theirs. Or D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
I have a hard time believing this would ever happen. Like, this is very confusing to me. Like, so there's like a vision, right? For maybe the departure from the vision is like style or genre, or like I'm trying to figure out how I could be on such a different page from multiple department heads if they're having weekly meetings with me and if we're going through a lookbook and if we've talked about this. Sounds like this is a problem that has resulted from not treating your friends like professionals and treating them like friends throughout all of pre-production and just prep in general, maybe. Yeah. So like, never work with your friends, first of all, I think is an issue. Like, you can become friends with people who work on your film, but you don't like start friends and then bring them in. You bring people in because you respect their talent and their creative contribution to your film. You don't bring them in because you like them. So, number one rule. Second, it's really hard to weigh in without knowing how far from my vision they are trailing. I mean, if it's like, what would be an example of this, Ulrich? Like, what would be like, the dresser is blue instead of red? Like, what? I don't understand. Like, I think you just got to right the wrongs. You just got to get people back on track. And you have to like, start having regular communication. These things happen when you're not communicating regularly. And when the departments aren't talking to each other and when you don't have a design, an aesthetic and a plan. So I wouldn't be working with these people, first of all. Second of all, I would work to get them back on track and get them back to the intention. And then it's like, thirdly, you should always trust who you hire and like trust what they're bringing to the table. But it sounds like the real problem here isn't that you, the real problem is that you didn't bring on people you trusted. You brought on your friends. You brought on people whose company you enjoy. So that's, I think, like, that's course correction number one.
Yeah, I feel like you're right. This is all about communication in the beginning. Like, if you've done your job right, like, you have told them a little bit about your vision before handing them the script. So they, like, know, like, a little bit of what you're trying to do. So, like, the chance that they would come back to you with something drastically different, like, seems, like, correctable if you've done your job correctly, first off. And then B, like you said, kind of unlikely, you know, because
you should be approving all purchases. You should be like for them to like spend a bunch of money and then come back and say, whoops, that doesn't, there's like 45 steps that are missing in that.
And
right.
And then wardrobes are being changed and sets are being styled differently. Like, I like this idea that like, you know, things could be changing, but like, you know, you're never going to buy a wardrobe that then you would have another wardrobe replace it. Like, that just doesn't, it's not a realistic thing. So if something was purchased, like, they're not going to change it unless they're a complete nut, you know? And you probably wouldn't like be working with a nutty person like that, most likely. So I don't know. I mean, just for the sake of argument, just for the question, you know, without like breaking down the integrity of the question completely.
Sorry, Eric.
I would say I always try to find the middle ground. That's like basically the way that I work in general, you know, is like always trying to find a place where we're all like kind of feeling like we're getting what we want out of the project or the decision or whatever, you know, so that we're all, it's like, you know, cause to his point, like, you are bringing people in because you want their artistry and you want their creativity and like, but it does need to be focused within the beam of your vision too, right? You know, so, but like, you, especially when it's something for free and low budget, like, you can't restrict people too much, you know?
But you can't think that everything, you can't operate a set feeling like everyone is just doing you a favor. Like, that's just like a pile of guilt on your shoulders. Like, you can't, how are you just supposed to be creative if you're just like, I feel so bad. Why are they even here? I should let them go. They're not having any fun. You know, it's like, there's just like baggage. So it's like, never bring people on who aren't electing because they want to join the production because they will get something creatively and professionally out of it.
Yeah, I basically think if someone's agreed to join on a project, it's because they want to do it for other reasons besides they like you. Like, they're doing it because it's going to help their career in some way. They're getting creative satisfaction out of it. They like the movie. They want to be on set. Like, whatever it is. So, like, when someone agrees, I basically have this thing where I just like assume they care as much as I do and like let them tell me if they don't care as much as I do. And if I'm asking too much out of them or if I'm pushing them too hard or whatever. But I mean, obviously I'm not going to ask for like, you know, everything, but like I basically just assume that they want to be here and they're excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that's like a good baseline to be working on creatively. Like, you don't want to
like you said, come into a baseline where you're like, think like you're forcing your friends to do this, you know, because it's not helpful for anybody. It's not helpful for the movie. It's not helpful for them. It's not helpful for you. It just makes it a bad thing. So yeah, I see what you mean. Like kind of in the A, like you don't want to go too much towards the A answer of like letting your friends have free reign.
No.
Like out of guilt because you're happy they're there. It's like, because then, you know, you're not going to be happy because the movie's going to not be what you want it to be and potentially be terrible, you know? So, like, you've got to have a middle ground for sure, you know? Lay down the law. I love that. Yeah, I'm laying down the law here, people.
Just don't hire your friends. Don't hire your friends. It's like my parents always were like, don't do business for your friends. Don't ever do business with your friends. Like, it's just complicated. Like, that's what this is. You're doing business with your friends. It's a bad idea. Have acquaintances that you're friendly with that you respect the talent of. That's working together. Don't, like, bring your best friend on because you're like, they're my best friend. I'm loyal to them. No.
No. I've tried working with my friends before. Don't always go so well. Sometimes it's very bad.
Yes.
So, but sometimes it can be okay, but it just depends on the relationship, I guess. But I think that's a pretty good rule to follow. But anyways, let us know what you think. Yeah. Are we on the money? Do we get it right? Should we lay down the law? What would you guys do in this situation? But Liz.
Yeah, wait. No, I want to say.
You say.
That we have a new iTunes review. We have a new iTunes review. Pretty exciting. So at least someone likes us. 5 stars. I say that because you were like, hey, dear, you know, I'm trying it back to your last comment. In general, I know a few people like us, but this is one more person. And his name is John DeMacus. And John says, love this podcast. And there are 2 exclamation points. You know, he really means it.
Mm.
He said, as a filmmaker myself, I thoroughly enjoy the honest take on all things filmmaking. Keep up the great work. And John, you got it. You got it. We will keep up the great work. John's username is Restless Heart from the United States.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. And if you like that, you could always send, or if you want to top John, wow, you're like, John does not encapsulate the joy I feel when I listen to this podcast. You could send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. You can like the show, you know, like on Facebook and Instagram, stuff like that. You could subscribe, things like that. You can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. We want to shout out the ISA, the International Screenwriters Association. We just really like them, and they're like a promotional partner of ours. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through the programs they offer. Head on over to networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Tate Haniok for coming on the show. Thanks to the Austin Film Festival for making this episode happen. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.
Sci-fi horror filmmaker and my first feature film, The Alternate, will be coming out later. Well, no, it's not out there this year. Let me do that again. Jeff, take 2.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.